song is called The Prophet, done for us by Michael Carr. It is 9 minutes after the hour. It is a Monday morning, and of course that means when we're fortunate, and that's almost every week now, we get to talk with Dr. Don Clark, board member at Creation Moments, and a biochemist. He is, as I say, our resident biochemist, the only scientist we have on staff here at Broken Road Radio. And Don, we do kind of ask you to wear lots of scientific hats, don't we? I mean, geologist and biochemist, which you are, and what other kind of scientists are there?
Cosmologist.
All those things, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You name it.
Cosmologist.
It doesn't really matter what the science is. Mm-hmm. The principles are, you know, the same from field to field. Of course, the mathematical equations may or can be different. but if we're talking about science, then, yeah, let's try to link whatever science that we can find to something interesting in the Bible, let's say.
Now, in your years hanging around science and scientists, have you noticed a personality type, someone who maybe you would say, well, he's prone to a career in science, he would be really good in science, versus, say playing the saxophone? I mean, can you see a certain, like, type A personalities? Are they very logical people? Are they creative and imaginative? What, have you noticed a pattern?
When you go to scientific conventions, is it kind of like you're all brothers of a different mother? you all kind of think alike, and you know, and it's that would be kind of like we'd go to a disc jockey convention. And it'd be all these people speaking the same language.
Yeah. Oh, you're down and out too, we would say.
Yeah, it's interesting because you would certainly have, you know, those which you would call geeks. But you find the flamboyant types who typically, because of their more extroverted personality, might be the ones that are trying to lead, you know, the discussions, for example, mm-hmm. and overpowering some of the more introverted type of thoughtful, you know, people. So, it's a mix, but most of the time you would find, very creative. Sometimes creative from the point of view of artistic, roles in there as well. But certainly, logical, certainly thoughtful would be some of the descriptions mm-hmm. of the folks that you might find.
You know, we talked with Mike Armitage not too long ago, and we were talking about his discovery of soft tissue in dinosaur bones and all the opposition that engendered. He seemed to be a very flamboyant kind of guy, very enthusiastic about what he was doing, excited about his sphere of activity. Was really, but I don't see that in all. You're very quiet and composed. You're. I don't want to say more dignified. That's not the word, but I mean, you've chosen to grow wine. You've stepped out of biochemistry, the scientific world, because, and you've explained this to us. You had some dissatisfaction there, didn't you?
Well, yes. Some scientists spend their lifetime just exploring one tiny aspect of whether it be in biochemistry, one biochemical mechanism, or one macromolecule, and they spend their whole life doing it. Which sometimes that's what's needed, but for me, I needed variation. I mean, mm-hmm. I needed more, more things to explore and to think about. And I like to think about, you know, the world around me mm-hmm. and, how that's created. Now, you know, growing grapes is certainly, biology and biochemistry experience helps me a little bit there. But certainly making wine is very much in the microbiology
mm-hmm.
and biochemistry and chemistry realm, because mm-hmm. There's a lot that you need to do chemistry-wise to make sure that your wine is balanced, even before you start throwing some yeast in there.
I imagine that any winemaker mm-hmm. would have to, to be successful and to grow, would have to have some scientific resources at their fingertips, maybe a biochemist on staff, although he might go by a different name than biochemist.
Right.
You know.
You don't necessarily need a biochemist, but it certainly helps to have, I mean, you definitely need some chemistry, basic chemistry, you know, understanding, because there's a lot of analysis, you know, that does go into winemaking. And the more of that you have, and certainly the more biochemistry you might have, would be helpful. And it's almost like, I mean, you're in a biotechnology field, except that you're not trying to manipulate genes.
Well, you could be,
trying,
though, couldn't you?
You're trying to grow, you know, these, you're trying to grow a culture of yeast, basically. In an environment that initially is very, very good for growing yeast, that is, with the sugars and the nutrients that are in the grapes. But then the alcohol that's produced is, you know, what eventually kills off the yeast because, you know, it gets too high for them and then they die off. So, it's an interesting field, and
Genetics,
I feel quite comfortable in it, really.
There would be some genetics work, I would think, in developing grapes, though. You know, you're crossbreeding, and you have hybrid grapes and different, and you try to perfect grapes. Aren't there genealogists maybe working in that field?
Geneticists, you mean? That's a good question. I mean, there is certainly, you know, all the hybrids that are being created, and new hybrids are actually, you know, even being done today because trying to overcome disease pressure, for example, and trying to develop a, well, in our area, for example, which is we've got a disease that's caused, that is vectored or carried by a leaf hopper called the sharpshooter. And that's Pierce disease. Well, the insect carries a bacteria that they inject into the vine when they're trying to suck out the juice from the vine. And that bacteria then clogs the phloem and the nutrients flowing up and down the vine. And then the vine looks like it's basically you haven't watered it in a while. So the leaves dry up, and then eventually the whole vine dries up. So there's an effort out in California trying to cross native resistant vines to vinifera, for example, and produce a Cabernet, you know, Sauvignon grape, for example, that has resistance to this particular type of disease. And by far, I mean, that's a pretty complicated process and very tedious process, because you've got to keep crossbreeding and crossbreeding and crossbreeding so that you can maintain the flavor of the Cabernet grape without, you know, having the flavor characteristics of the, let's say, Native American grape, which may not, you know, taste so great. So it's a challenge, but there seems to be some success in doing that, and some field trials are going on as we speak, and some field trials just started this year.
So there is some genetics work going on in grapes, then, as opposed to, say, just grafting plants together to create hybrids. I mean, that would be the old system. The new system would be actually manipulating genes to get the product that you're looking for. So, and I'm trying really hard here to come up with a way to segue from wine and grapes into coal.
Perhaps. How about this? There were so many wine fields in Noah's time that all that vegetation produced more coal.
That could be.
How's that?
There you go.
How's that?
Well, there's got to be a reason for all that coal. And Don has called our attention to an article from Answers Magazine here. And it's entitled, How Did We Get All This Coal? By Dr. Andrew Snelling. The article first out in February of 2013. And they've reprised the article again today. And this article looks very much like it was composed or written as a retort to those who would kind of curl their upper lip at the idea of young earth creationism and say, okay, then, smarty pants young earth creationist, if the earth is only 6,000 years old and there was this flood 4,300 years ago, how then do you explain the presence of all this coal? I ask you. And Dr. Stelling apparently has an answer, doesn't he?
Well, he does, and he's very much a young earth creationist and is certainly within the creationist realm a very well-respected geologist. And so he has tackled several difficult problems, and this is one of them. So that's the that's one of the questions. The other question is, how fast does coal form? Because the traditional answers to those questions is that this happened over periods of millions and millions and millions of years, and coal formation from peat is a very slow process, and so, you know, therefore the earth is old.
Well, let's talk about coal basically here then. Coal is carbon, and it's made of plants and animal matter that are carbon-based, so they would tend to die, be buried, gradually be covered over by the earth, and gradually get down to where there was all this compression and heat. And so it would take this millions of years to convert the decaying vegetable and animal matter now all together into something called coal. Isn't that the how coal is formed, or the standard thinking?
Well, yeah, the standard thinking is that the coal is formed from peat, is dead vegetable matter.
Not animals.
No, not so much. Animals, of course, animals and vegetable matter have a role in oil formation.
Oil, okay. Okay, I always thought it was the same process.
Yeah. Coal is, peat is degrading, you know, vegetable
it's
matter.
It's like compost.
Plants.
Kind of, yeah.
And so you have from peat, then you compress it and you put a little heat on it without the presence of oxygen, and then you form coal. So the question, like I said, is that's where coal comes from, and the question is, how did we get so much coal? And there are literally there is a lot of coal buried, you know, beneath the earth's surface. And it's not just, of course, America has a bunch of coal, but Canada, Australia, China, South Africa, and other countries have tons and tons and tons and tons, literally tons of coal. So much coal that our energy requirements could, in fact, be satisfied with coal, with the use of coal for, you know, hundreds of years to come. But, of course, we know that the green folks, worrying about CO2, which we've talked about many times on this program.
Yes, we have.
Pretty much trying to shut down the coal industry, at least in the United States. And so, anyway, but we have a tremendous amount of coal, which could be used. It was originally estimated that the vegetation that we have on the earth today would only produce 3% of the coal deposits that we have. So how could all of this vegetation, you know, be formed, especially something like a global flood, which meant that all of the vegetation had to be there at the present time, at the time of the flood, and be buried at the time of the flood in order to be produced, not to mention, you know, let's talk about the time frame later. So we got to tackle that problem first, and that's what Dr. Snelling does. And in the assumptions behind that particular calculation, and the assumption was that it takes, let's say, 8 to 10 feet of peat in order to make coal.
To make one foot of coal, yeah.
Yeah, to make 1 foot of coal. Mm-hmm. So that's... 8 to 10 ratio, 8 to 10 to 1 ratio. But if you look at the amount of energy in in peat and you look at the amount of energy in coal, you come up with a different ratio, and that's more like 2-to-1 and close to 1-to-1. So you have obviously a drastically different percentage. So the 3% then becomes something like 15-30%. Well, 15-30% is still not 100%. So where did the other percentage come from?
So now we're saying that the vegetation currently on Earth could only have been converted to maybe 15-18% of the actual coal reserves in the ground now. So we're suggesting here that there must have been lots more vegetation at some point.
Yes. So before the flood, there had to be a lot more vegetation. So let's talk about that a little bit. Before the flood, for example, if you assume, and the creationists do assume this, that continents were all together before the flood in a supercontinent called Pangaea, then you have a larger continent, larger landmass, and the water surrounding that landmass, probably it was a more gentler slope, for example, going out into the seas or the seas around that landmass. That landmass was also situated in a position where vegetation was covering the whole landmass and not just the warmer parts of the landmass that we have, you know, today.
Well, and we've talked about that too, and it bears mention here that you've told us that in pre-flood times that the climate on the Earth was pretty much uniform from pole to pole. It did not vary so much by latitude like it does today.
Right, and that the pole was part of this Pangaea. So,
and there is, in fact, proof or the evidence that there was significant plant growth at either, well, at the South Pole was land. The North Pole right now is water. So mainly Antarctica was largely right. Vegetated at one time.
Yeah. So vegetation, so if you take that into account, then you've got, significantly more vegetation than just the current amount of vegetation on the Earth today. So you go from, let's say, 50% vegetation, now you're going up to 100% vegetation. So that gets you a little bit, closer to what you need. But it appears that there was, some peat bogs, if you will, even over the water around the land. So mm-hmm. The land, vegetation didn't just stop with the land, but it continued out into the water a ways. And we've got examples of this, around various parts of the the globe, where you've got vegetation going out, into the water, where the there's a gentler slope, from the seashore, for example, and you don't have the dramatic drop into deep waters.
Well, of course, even us being in lake country here, we see that in lakes. They call it eutrophication. In a lake, over time, will convert to land. I mean, it tends to grow floating bogs, then they progress, and they thicken, and they deepen, and gradually that lake disappears. So I imagine the same thing would happen around the edge of Pangaea, the continent.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. So now you take that, go ahead, David, you had a question?
Yeah, there was, I just flashed on something called the Sargasso Sea. At one time was a large floating mass of vegetation that was down in the, seemed like a Caribbean. Or perhaps east of the Caribbean somewhere. And it was something that sailors, in the 17th century couldn't sail through because, the ships couldn't get through it. I'm not even sure whatever happened to that. But
I think I'll look it up while you guys talk here.
Yeah. I'm not necessarily familiar with that. But anyway, we do have examples of large vegetation. Out in the sea. And so all of that would suggest that there's, plenty of vegetation pre-flood to form all the coal formations that we have today. The other aspect of this is that the pre-flood, the conditions around the Earth were more ideal for life to begin with. And so the vegetation would have been larger and more vigorous and thicker, than we have today. And there's, certainly fossil evidence to suggest that there is a lot of large vegetation that we see, in the fossil records. And so all of that combined then produces the vegetation that you need in order to, make all of the coal beds that we see today. Now, what about converting, this vegetation into coal? And how long does that take? Well, there have been experiments, in the lab looking at conversion, for example, from vegetation, plant material, and to coal. And it just so turns out that if you have a little bit of clay mixed in with your plant material, which, of course, at the time of the flood, you'd have a lot of minerals and clay and sand and stuff mixed in with the coal because of all the agitation that's taking place during the dramatic disruption of the Earth at the time of the flood. But if you take a little bit of clay and then mix that in with the coal, warm the coal up in oxygen absent conditions, and you don't have to warm it up all that much, let's say to 250 to 300 degrees, then you're looking at coal formation within 75 days, for example.
So really? Months, not years. Months, not centuries. Months, not months. Eons. Yeah.
Right. Of course, the lower the temperature, the slower the process. Mm-hmm. The lower the pressure, the slower the process. So all of this is pressure temperature, related. It takes days if it's 300 degrees, and it takes, if it's 250 degrees with a lower pressure, then it takes, the experiments show, it can happen over 75 days. So if we're talking about, coal buried about a mile deep or so, there would be no problem whatsoever forming it within a short period of time. And so the conditions are there after the flood. The vegetation appears to be there after the flood. And so the flood is a good model for how all of this vegetation got here. Pre-flood conditions is a good model for the amount of vegetation that was needed in order to produce all this coal. So the coal deposits, point to a young Earth. It doesn't require millions and millions of years to, produce the coal. And
let me play devil's advocate here. I'm not sure that that's the case. What it does is remove an objection on behalf of young Earth creationists. It says that if the Earth was formed 6,000 years ago and there was a flood 4,300 years ago, there's a perfectly logical explanation for the coal to have gotten here. So that, that's not an argument you can use against young Earth creationists. But what it doesn't say is could that coal have been formed before the flood, for example? Maybe it's been there all along. How would we know? Have they actually dated the coal? Can they date layers of coal? Because I imagine, I'm reading here that coal is found in layers several feet thick, typically horizontal layers, which that does suggest a confined time period, not a constant production of coal, but maybe a single event. I mean, what are the assumptions here when you find coal in a layer like that?
Well, you find coal not only in layers, multiple layers. some inches thick, some, you know, feet thick. And if you look at, let's say, striations that you find in the Grand Canyon or any of the canyons in the, you know, used to be mud, now they're rock layers. Mm-hmm. The sedimentary layers, it certainly suggests that you had multiple catastrophic events. Normally, you know, in the traditional, you know, thinking, well, you know, that happened over a period of time and it just wasn't one mm-hmm. event. But we know, for example, from Mount St. Helens, that these events can be, you know, very, very quickly. And the flood is a perfect model for generating all these coal layers. And in a kind of a shear type of format where you had a bunch of vegetation, you know, being, you know, laid down with mixed in with, you know, the sand and the mud, and then layer of mud coming on top of that, multiple layers of mud, then another, you know, bunch of vegetation. As the waters, you know, were splashing around, if you will, mm-hmm. You know, at the time of the flood, shortly after the flood, when a lot of geological activity, you know, took place.
So you would maintain that the flood actually created coal?
Absolutely. Laid down the vegetation. Mm-hmm. You know, it killed all the vegetation, obviously. And it laid down the vegetation that was, you know, necessary for these coal beds. The other thing you find is, you know, fossils in these coal beds, various types of, you know, crustaceans, for example, are often mixed in with this, and so evidence of needing obviously water and animals. that would be in, you know, in that water. So it's not a, inconsistent at all with the flood. And then the other aspect of this is the amount of vegetation and the type of vegetation. Some of the vegetation, like I said, is very, very large compared to samples that we have today. And certainly suggest it was over water, like the bogs that I was describing before, mm-hmm. because it's quite open structure and tubular, like you would find in kind of boggy mm-hmm. boggy areas.
So there's evidence of what I can only call prehistoric vegetation, then types of vegetation that we don't see today. But it's
right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, more in quote prehistoric, but mm-hmm. it's antediluvian. I mean,
yes,
it's pre-flood.
More accurately,
you know. So your basis, I mean, your picture of how the world was formed and the events that took place, you know, in our history, you know, for us Bible believers. You know, Genesis is a historical record.
It's definitive.
It's what?
Definitive.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so if we take it as an historical record, then we can use this history book as a guide to explaining the world around us, even, you know, explaining the stuff that we have around us today, especially on Earth, because obviously the Bible is more... more directed at the events on the Earth than it is necessarily out in space, although there are some answers there too.
Mm-hmm. And the article posits this coal as a gift of God as well, that He's provided for our energy needs.
Yeah, yes, mm-hmm. And as well, you know, we you know, of course, we talked a little bit about oil, but oil kind of falls into the same category
mm-hmm.
because where did all the oil deposits come from? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Same type of process, except now you got not only dead vegetation with, you know, oily vegetation, but you also have oily animals that is contributing to the oil deposits, and a violent event that trapped a lot of vegetation and a lot of animals in a short period of time.
So we could say that the very presence of these coal layers, and well, I don't know if oil falls into that same category, but the coal layers at least would indicate a cataclysmic event like the flood happened. Can we date the coal layers?
I'm sure they've been dated. Whether or not, I don't know. I'd have to look into that. I'm sure the coal layers have been dated. Some of the dates that I've heard are, you know, in the millions of years time frame.
We've heard that before, but with other rocks and things, though, too. So, and that, that turns out
I'd
to be
have
kind
to
of
look at the how the, you know, how the coal is dated. I mean, you should be able to date it by carbon-14 because it. You know, like I said, I mean, it should, if it happened at the time of the flood, we're looking at, 4,300 years or so ago, and not millions of years ago.
Well, let me ask this then. Is there consensus within the scientific community that there indeed was a global flood event, regardless of when they date it?
No, there is not.
Uh-huh.
Even though, you know, this is another piece of evidence. I mean, how do you get these major coal deposits around the globe? Some of them appear to have been connected at one point in time, although the continents are pretty far apart, let's say from America over to Europe and Russia. You know, how do you explain that with... a theory that, well, okay, it's all just happened at one time. Or how did it happen at one time? I mean, why did it happen at one time? Clearly, a lot of water was involved. And because of the sedimentary rock that's around the coal. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know why, you know, scientists still believe that there aren't, you know, there wasn't a global flood, because you can look at, I mean, this is just one area that you can look at and say, gee, this looks like it all happened around the same time, not on the same day, but certainly within the same year or two, you know, post flood. And
is there consensus on the existence of Pangaea, then, the one unified continent?
Well, there's consensus on that because if you take core samples at the edge of the continents, and that's how it was originally, discovered that, wow, it looks like the continents were all one piece at one time, by taking core samples and saying this, you know, this layer of core looks like the other layer of core, which is across the ocean. Mm-hmm. And so these continents must have been joined at one point in time. And so there's definitely enough geological evidence to say that the continents were put together. Not to say that everybody believes that, but there is certainly there's a large amount of supporting evidence. Now, of course, the traditional thinking is that, again, this took millions and millions of years for the continents to move apart. And there is, of course, evidence that that doesn't necessarily have to be millions of years, but that they can move apart quickly. And, of course, there's a creation model for that as well.
And that kind of presumes, that view kind of presumes maybe a constant rate, and there's no reason to think there was a constant rate from the beginning. If there was an energy shock to the earth that broke them up, they would have been moving faster to begin with.
Look at the subduction that's happening around the globe today, the subduction of the, let's say, the ocean under the landmass that's happening today. Look at that rate and say, okay, that was the rate at the time, let's say, of the flood, because, we had, like I said, major events taking place. So...
Well, and incidentally, that's for another day. Yeah,
and another another story.
We've covered a lot of ground. By the way, the Sargasso Sea, David, is in the middle of the North Atlantic, and it kind of borders. It's north and east of the Caribbean, and it's more an area of circular currents than it is a seaweed. Although there were masses of seaweed there, first seen by Christopher Columbus in 1492, he was amazed by the sargassum seaweed, but I think most of that was floating because the currents tend to carry all kinds of flotsam and jetsam into that area. It's in a circular pattern, and it's more of a problem for sailing ships because of the winds die down. That's what they call the horse latitude. So it's a treacherous area for sailing ships, not because of masses of seaweed so much as because of a lack of wind.
Ah, okay. So that's back to coal for a second, Don. One of the things that's in the back of my head is, what about diamonds? I mean, this article was kind of a surprise to me. Not that I've always accepted the notion that it took long periods of time under pressure to make coal, and it took diamonds even longer. So how are diamonds?
Well, yeah, diamond formation would take longer, but you know, it probably wouldn't have. I'm sure it doesn't take as long as you think, given the right. I mean, as long as the traditional thinking is, given the right conditions, and in the right conditions being, you know, obviously you form diamonds with the lack of oxygen, which you would have if it's entrapped in, you know, multiple layers of mud. And then, obviously, you need pressure, and a little bit of heat would help the process as well. We can form diamonds in the lab. They're not perfect, and they're not as clear and as we have in nature. And it's the other aspect of where are diamonds found? I mean, a lot of diamonds are found in Africa. mm-hmm. There's a lot of coal in Africa as well. So the question is the diamonds near these coal beds, which would be an interesting thing to explore, and I don't know the answer to that, but it's obviously it mentions in this article that the coal, there's a lot of coal in South Africa. And I think the diamonds are more in the central part of Africa. So, is there a relationship between these coal beds and the diamond beds, if you will? That's a good question. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And it says, I just did a quick Google search, and it says diamonds are not formed in coal.
Ah, well, there you go.
Yeah, that's some sort of a myth. But natural diamonds require high temperatures and exist only at depths of 87 to 120 miles down. So it's not necessarily the time, or time is one function, but it's depth.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, carbon, concentrated forms of carbon, were at the bottom of the existing oceans, perhaps at the time of the flood, or maybe before.
Well, and maybe the continents, I'm way into speculation now, maybe the continents drifting apart very quickly and the subductions and the if the ocean land is going under the land very quickly, that would get some vegetation possibly pulled under with it, and with the heat of all of that could possibly have formed the diamonds. Now, we can't rule out that, of course, God created the diamonds at the time of creation of the earth, because we have certainly examples of minerals and gems, for example, mentioned in the early chapters of Genesis.
Okay. Right. Well, it's interesting. And this is all from an article over at Answers in Genesis, and we will link to this in the podcast, provide a link for you. The podcast will be up here in a couple of hours at brokenroadradio.com. And also on brokenroadradio.com, you can discover a link to creationmoments.com. earthcreationism.com, and you'll discover there just a wealth of resources about young earth creationism. And a lot of that is science. It's evidence. And I think you find it a fascinating place to spend some time, creationmoments.com. Again, you can link to it from our website at brokenroadradio.com. Dr. Don with the board of directors at Creation Moments and joins us every Monday. And Don, we're so grateful. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, you're quite welcome, and it's been fun, as usual.
All right.
All right, good.
We'll see you next Monday, okay? All right.